It's Words and Pictures. Guest host Ken Jones sits down with graphic novelist Michael Kupperman. Don't forget that you can hear all these programs after they air on KBOO.FM or on iTunes and Google Play. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to KBOO.FM and or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
Tune in to KBOO on July 4th through the 7th for our live broadcast from the 32nd Annual Waterfront Blues Festival. We'll start the broadcast from the Waterfront Blues Festival on Thursday, July 4th at noon, and broadcast the fest every day from noon through 10 p.m. Again, that's the Waterfront Blues Festival, the largest celebration of blues, soul, funk, and rhythm and blues west of the Mississippi, July 4th through the 7th from noon to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is the writer Miriam Taves. Taves has a BA in Film Studies from the University of Manitoba and a journalism degree from the University of King's College in Halifax. She's both produced radio documentaries and written for magazines and garnered the 1999 National Magazine Award Gold Medal for Humor. Taves also played the leading role in Carlos Regatta's film Silent Light, a film that took place in a Mennonite colony in northern Mexico. Silent Light was the winner of the jury prize at the 2007 Cannes Film Festival, was on many film critics' lists of the best films of the year, and is a film for which Taves was nominated for Best Actress at the Mexican Academy of Cinematographic Arts and Sciences Ariel Awards. Miriam Taves is, however, best known not for her past journalism, nor for her all-too-brief film career, but for her life as a story novelist. Taves is the author of 6 novels and 1 memoir, including Summer of My Amazing Luck, A Complicated Kindness, and All My Puny Sorrows. She's the winner of many of Canada's most prestigious literary awards, including the Canadian Authors Association Award, the Rogers Writers Trust Fiction Prize, the McNally Robinson Book of the Year Award, and the Governor General's Award, whose past winners include such luminaries as Margaret Atwood, Michael Ondaatje, and Alice Munro. Miriam Taves is here today to talk about her latest book out from Bloomsbury entitled Women Talking. Described by Margaret Atwood as an amazing, sad, shocking, but touching novel based on a real-life event that could be right out of Handmaid's Tale, Women Talking has received starred reviews from Publishers Weekly, Kirkus, and Booklist. Lainey Zumas says of Women Talking, "I am in awe of this novel. In Taves' brilliant design, 8 women in a Mennonite hayloft managed to lay bare the rancid global root system of patriarchy. Their story is terrifying, joyful, gruesome, and magnetic. What a reckoning, what a gift." Madeline Tien adds, "Women Talking wants another world to be possible, and in the rescripting of reality into fiction, attempts to imagine it where it has not yet grown of its own volition. The novel reminds us how difficult it is to know how to live, forgive others or ourselves, seek justice or know freedom. No matter the depth of their solidarity, we can imagine that each individual will undoubtedly spend a lifetime coming to their own answers, seeking knowledge with their own hard-won words. But we can hope that the common questions asked by women talking, in the book Women Talking, their listening, their anger and love, their sometimes vastly differing conclusions, might offer a further way of seeing and finally choosing." Welcome to Between the Covers, Miriam Taves.
Thanks very much.
So when we open the book, we encounter not the beginning of the novel, but an author's note that discusses a real life situation that your novel is an imaginative reaction to. So before we talk about the novel itself, I'd love to ground listeners around the real life event and also your orientation to it. So perhaps we can start with the encounter in nonfictional form that we encounter as readers, and that inspired you to write the book.
Mm-hmm. Between the years 2005 and 2009, the girls and women of the Manitoba colony in Bolivia, named after Manitoba, the province where I'm from, and where these particular Mennonites came from as well, this is an ultra conservative closed Mennonite colony, and the girls and the women were waking up, realizing that they had been attacked in some way. They were sore, they were bleeding, they had rope marks, burn marks on their wrists, on their ankles. They didn't know what had happened. So these attacks continued to happen. The women started talking a little bit amongst themselves about what was happening, realizing that they weren't alone, that this was happening to virtually every woman and girl in the colony. And so they started telling some of the leaders of the colony, the elders, who basically their response was, no, this is your imagination, or that, you know, they used the expression, you know, the term wild female imagination, this is the work of the devil or of demons, Satan, as punishment for, you know, some sort of perceived sin that the women had committed, apparently. So they weren't believed, and not only were they not believed, but they were blamed for these attacks. So, you know, so they continued until finally, as the reports go, as the story goes, as the rumors go, one woman or two women stayed up late night after night, and eventually caught one of the perpetrators, and then the whole thing unraveled. Others confessed. There were seven or eight men from the colony, Mennonite men, who were responsible for the rapes, and even then, the question was, what do we do with these men? Naturally, some of the people who had been raped, the male family members, especially of these women, you know, wanted to punish these men somehow, seek revenge, and so basically, for the first time, the outside, the police were called in to basically arrest the men, take them to the city, put them on trial, and sentence them, and so you know, now the rumors within the Mennonite community are that the men are in prison, but there are also rumors that the attacks are continuing. These colonies are self-policed, self-governed colonies, very isolated. The women don't speak the language of the country that they're in this case, Bolivia. They're illiterate. They don't leave the colony without being accompanied by a man, a husband, a father, etc. So there's nothing for them to do. They're virtual prisoners in these colonies, and then victimized over and over in this, you know, this culture of control and shame. So this is one way, and again, I go to lengths wherever I am and whenever I'm talking about this to explain that this is one way of being Mennonite. These old order closed colonies, ultra conservative colonies in remote places. That's sort of, you know, one extreme end of the spectrum. I'm a Mennonite. I'm a secular Mennonite. I am. Literate, educated, live in a city, for example. So it's just important for people to know that not all Mennonites live in this, you know, in this manner.
Hmm. Well, the victims in the real life situation, they ranged from the age of 3 years old to 65. They were married, single, residents of the colony, and visitors, and it included at least 130 women and girls. Over the course of at least 5 years, who would wake up bleeding, sometimes with semen or dirt or grass on them, because they'd been bound and carried out to a field unconscious. facilitated by an animal anesthetic from the plant belladonna that the rapists would spray into the house so that they could take their victims and then return them. Tell us what prompted you about this story, this seemingly fantastical yet real story, why you wanted to engage with this in novel form.
Mm-hmm. When I heard about the rapes, I was horrified like everybody else, but I wasn't surprised. I think I know other Mennonites who are familiar with these communities, you know, feel the same way. The incidence of sexual violence, of domestic assault and incest and violence are, you know, and patriarchal violence specifically within these colonies is, you know, they're so sky high in terms of the numbers. This kind of horrific sort of series of crimes was not surprising given the culture, given the roles of men and women within the community, the entitlement of the men, the dehumanization of the women, the inherent misogyny of the fundamentalism that, you know, that they preach, the interpretation of the Bible. Again, it wasn't surprising. But at the same time, you know, I wanted to, I'm a novelist, so my thoughts, you know, generally go towards wanting to craft some sort of narrative around this stuff that and I knew that I wanted to. I had so many questions that were really basically extensions of the questions that I've had all of my life growing up in a Mennonite, in a very conservative Mennonite community. And here, after hearing about these crimes, the questions were raised again in my mind, and I wanted to address them in my fiction. But it took me, years really to figure out how to do it, how to enter the story in a sense, how to structure the story. I wrote a different book in the meantime, I was taking notes. I was reading, what I could, and talking to people who were and are directly connected to some of the members of the colony.
Well, before we go to the place of how you took this nonfiction event and brought it into fiction, I mean, I do love the way the book begins, particularly given the fact that the women were being accused, or the cause of the rapes was originally attributed to the wild female imagination. And then we open with this line: women talking is both a reaction through fiction to these real events and an act of female imagination, a very barbed and appropriately barbed beginning. But before we look at the ways you bring it into fiction, I was wondering if we could just parse a little more your orientation as a Mennonite, because you did mention that you're a secular Mennonite, and that there's a wide variety of ways a person could be a Mennonite in the world, and varying degrees of relationship to modernity, where the old colonists don't have electricity or phones, don't use cars. That's not going to be true across the board. You're going to see a wide array. But even within the idea of a fundamentalist Mennonite community, the one that you grew up in, a fundamentalist Mennonite community in Manitoba, and the old colony Mennonites, both come from Russia originally, but they're not the same either, and they don't have the same relationship to each other. So could you parse that a little bit for us, the difference between fundamentalist Mennonite community like the one you knew and an old colony Mennonite community? What are the overlaps, and what are the differences that come to mind?
It's funny. I was talking with some of my friends from who also, of course, happen to be my relatives, because we're all related in the communities that we come from. But and we were saying how, even though these closed colonies, one might think that, you know, they that the rules and that you know, the conditions are so extreme that they're somehow foreign to us, but really they're not. I mean, in the community that I grew up in, a fundamentalist community for sure, although we dressed differently. We weren't dressing in the uniform style, as it were, probably the wrong word to use, as the Mennonites in the colonies, who are, you know, very recognizable with their long dresses, the women with the long dresses and hair covering, and the men in their overalls and hats. You know, and though we did drive cars, in my Mennonite community and had electricity, et cetera, really the rules were the same. The sins the possibility, the vast array of sins that we could be committing at any given time, often, you know, to our own bewilderment, that kind of groupthink, the emphasis on punishment, on guilt, on shame, on silence. And again, that, you know, the very strict roles for men and for women. I mean, that was all the same. And again, you know, the fundamentalist interpretation of the scripture, you know, which is used by the elders, by the religious leaders in the community, in mine and in the closed colonies, to maintain order, and particularly, you know, power for those, you know, for the elite, you know, for the leaders, who are all male, of course. So, so in those kind of most fundamental ways, they're similar.
Do you see the old colonists leaving Canada for Mexico and then leaving Mexico for Belize and Bolivia as a way for them to maintain their own self-policing insular societies? I mean, are these emigrations prompted by something impinging upon them within the countries that they're living in, that they seek out other places where they can live in a way that's sort of hermetic and self-policed?
Absolutely, which again, you know, only perpetuates the violence. But because of that, you know, the self-policing and the hermetic, like you say, insularity of the colonies, and not that I am on board or believe in policing in the first place, or incarceration, or the justice system as it stands, but certainly that idea of self-governance is something that only further, you know, serves to harm and the most vulnerable in the colonies, who are usually women. But yeah, those Mennonites, and so, you know, the Russian Mennonites, this is my community of Mennonites, moving from when there is pressure from the government to assimilate, to put the kids in regular schools, for instance, to learn the language, to join the military, then the tradition is that then Mennonites, most of them, if not all, some stay behind and do assimilate or not, but will move to another country. And I hold, you know, some of these countries, you know, they're complicit as well by saying, okay, these Mennonites, we want to populate this, you know, particular part of our country. We can get these Mennonites in. We'll sell this land to them for cheap. They're looking for a place to practice their religion, someplace, you know, that's remote and isolated. They'll contribute to the economy. They'll stay out of trouble, you know, and we won't have to worry about them. And so, you know, it's that kind of deal that is so often made. So from Russia to Canada, and then, you know, from my communities specifically, Steinbach, which is my hometown, but other communities in the area, you know, when that government pressure, was put on them to assimilate, they many of them moved south to Mexico, to northern Mexico, to Chihuahua, to other places. And then again, it happens there, and then the Mennonites move further afield to, for instance, Belize, Paraguay, Bolivia. Now, I was recently told by somebody connected to the colonists that in Bolivia, that they're looking for land in Angola. So, you know, there's a constant migration, a constant movement of Mennonites searching for that part of the world, you know, where they're free to to, they would say, free to practice their religion. But I think that, of course, you know, with that comes also, you know, and they know this, you know, the freedom to not only to practice their religion, but also to engage in, you know, in harmful behavior, mm-hmm. and violent behavior.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Miriam Taves about her latest book, Women Talking. You did mention, Miriam, that it took you a while to figure out how to tell the story. And I think one of the most remarkable things about this book is that you didn't choose to tell it as a lurid enactment of the violence, or even a book about the trial of the men, that Women Talking is literally a book of women talking, it taking place after the rapists have been caught and before their trial, and the men of the colony have gone to town to try to post bail so that the accused rapists can come home to the community while awaiting trial, and perversely, so that the women can forgive them, so that the women's prospect of going to heaven isn't imperiled. And the novel is essentially the portrayal of eight women meeting in a hayloft, deciding what they're going to do before the men return in less than 2 days. And this feels like really an ingenious setup. And I wanted to ask you about the process of arriving at this as the structure and focus of the novel, but I also sort of want to partially hand off this question to a past guest, Catherine Lacey, to have her re-ask it in her own words, because she's the reason I first heard about the book when she was on Between the Covers, and she tweeted about it, and we talked about her tweet, and her tweet was, "Women Talking is the best contemporary novel I have ever read. I am usually not one for making digital noise about galleys, but Miriam Taves just elegantly demolished this whole century, and I cannot shut up about it." So when I knew you were coming on the show, I reached out to see if she had any questions, and I just want to read what she responded. "I'm still wondering what can even be asked of Taves. I really feel like that book is one of those remarkably complete works of art that resists all questions that aren't wide-eyed statements of wonder. It's such a complete, wholehearted book. Here's a question, perhaps. Were there any roads during the writing of Women Talking that turned out to be dead ends? Or put another way, how is the resulting book different from the book you may have anticipated? What was thrown out?" And then she says to me as an aside, "A part of me suspects, whether erroneously or not, that any masterpiece likely arrives on a direct route from mind to page, but perhaps that's too romantic a notion of the very human, messy route a book usually seems to take." So long story short, I was hoping you could talk about that thinking process, mm-hmm. because you arrive at this wonderful structure and conceit for how to enter the story, mm-hmm. but how was the beforehand of that and figuring that out?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I so admire Catherine Lacey that I'm just really appreciate those comments. thank you for that. I mean, and she knows, you know, she's right. I mean, there is, in a sense, on the one hand, yeah, it's, I think, with writing, with certain books, maybe all books, you know, when you've finished with the kind of preliminary circling around and circling around and circling around and trying to figure out how to enter the book, how to enter the story, you know, then there often does seem to be a kind of, you know, sort of, in a way, seamless sort of push towards the end where it seems as though, okay, yeah, this is the obvious choice. This is how it needs to be written. This is what I need to be asking. But before that happens, if that happens, it's all a little bit mysterious to me as well. But with this book, I did very, very briefly think about the idea of revenge, and you know, revenge is, I mean, revenge stories are stories, you know, books or films that I often do enjoy. I can appreciate them, but I realized very quickly that that's not really my, you know, MO, as they say. It's not, I'm not, you know, I'm not, that's not what I'm looking for, and that's not what I'm thinking about. It would be a kind of very temporary, superficial response that might be satisfying in the moment. But of course, you know, revenge only leads to more violence. And so I knew that wasn't the story that I wanted to tell, nor would it be a believable, it wouldn't be a realistic kind of response from the women either. At no point in the book, really, I mean, there are some characters, one in particular who is a little bit more vengeful than the others and, you know, rather homicidal and, you know, wanting to do these men harm for sure. But essentially, that's not what they're thinking about, what they're talking about. You know, the women are trying to figure out what, you know, what they will do in order to protect their children, to gain agency, to, you know, over their own lives, to be able to control their own lives, and also very importantly, to keep their faith. So the idea of revenge just didn't seem like a natural or a believable or honest thing that they would. But I did, you know, very, very early on, before I even started writing it, entertain that for maybe, you know, I remember walking around the block a few times and thinking, what if, you know, and quickly realizing that's not where I wanted to go.
There's this great line in the book that one of the women says, and it's, "There is no plot, only women talking." And when the women say plot, they're using it to say there's no plotting behind the women's back, but what is so great about the book is the book really is a book of quote unquote talking, but it's mesmerizing. The women are debating strategy, ethics, biblical interpretation, questions of identity and justice. And the book manages to be both very funny at times and fraught with tension as the clock is ticking, with the men about to return. And it feels like a book of women talking instead of plot underscores the act of women talking on their own terms and defining their own terms and debating the terms. It does feel like a revolutionary act. And I wanted to hear about this, because I think the women would reject the term revolutionary who are speaking it. But I wanted to hear about a little bit about the tension, or maybe a false tension, between talking and plot.
Mm-hmm. You're right. The women would absolutely deny that they were revolutionaries. That just wouldn't be a part of their thinking or their vocabulary. Or certainly they know that they're fighting against something, but at the same time they grapple with that too, because they're pacifists, they're non-resistors, they're, you know, the faith, the essential tenets of the faith are important to them, and so they don't think of themselves as revolutionaries, or that they are planning or plotting a revolution or some sort of insurgence, resistance, but for I guess in terms of the idea of women talking, I think is something that I have noticed in my community, and it's something that I have, you know, been dealing with all of my life, you know, from the Mennonite patriarchy, is that fear, the fact that it is such a threatening thing for, particularly, you know, these types of individuals, you know, authoritarian, religious, you know, controlling and rule bound, and the leaders of the Mennonite colonies in my own community as well. It's funny in a way that something like that can be so threatening. But I think that, you know, part of the entire machinery of these communities is, you know, the sort of the structure is, it's, you know, it's the built-in need to keep the women silent, to prevent them from talking to each other, to prevent them from taking control over their own lives, and particularly rebelling against the men.
It was a real honor to have you on the show and to be part of boosting the profile of women talking in the world.
It was a real honor to be here. Thank you very, very much.
We're talking today to Miriam Taves, the author of Women Talking. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Coley Neighborhood Farmers Market. This is a weekly event at 5011 Northeast 42nd Avenue at Alberta Street in Portland. The market features local farmers and businesses, and this Thursday, June 27th, there will also be a seasonal cooking demonstration and music by Loose Change. Again, that's the Coley Neighborhood's Farmers Market, Thursday, June 27th from 4 to 8 p.m. at 5011 Northeast 42nd Avenue at Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm. Coming up next, it's Words and Pictures. Guest host Ken Jones sits down with graphic novelist Michael Kupperman. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Dark Side Cinema, open every night and featuring independent, foreign, and art house films. The Dark Side is located at 215 Southwest 4th Street between Madison and Jefferson Avenues in Corvallis, Oregon. More information and showtimes is available online at darksidecinema.com.
We're on the air with the School Kids Questionnaire, brought to you by the makers of Alka-Seltzer and one-a-day brand vitamin tablets. And here they are, the Quiz Kids.
Welcome to another edition of Words and Pictures here on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Ken Jones, your host for today's show. In this episode, we interview Michael Kupperman, author of the book All the Answers from Simon & Schuster's Gallery 13. All the Answers is a graphic memoir of Michael's father, Joel Kupperman, who became famous during World War II as the youngest member of the Quiz Kids radio show and spent the rest of his life trying to escape that celebrity. The book was selected by Publishers Weekly as one of the best summer books of 2018 and more recently named one of the 2019 finalists for the very prestigious Will Eisner Comic Industry Award in the category of Best Reality-Based Work. The book is also a finalist for the 2019 Excellence in Graphic Literature Award in the Adult Nonfiction category.